Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good middle of the night, wherever you may find yourself around the world.
So hello and welcome back to DevelopPod, the podcast from the Teacher Development Special Interest Group of IATEFL. My name is James Taylor and I'm joined today by my co-hosts, Christian. Hi, Christian.
Hi, very nice to be here, James.
And Tanya.
Hello, James. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. It's been a while. Mm-hmm. It's good to be back. So today we're doing an episode where we're going to catch up on some of the previous episodes that we've published over the last year. Tanya, can you give us a quick idea about those episodes and what they had in common?
Yes, sure. So just a very brief background. We ran a competition last year, which offered six people the chance to win a free TD-SIG membership. The entrants were asked to write an article about a person within the industry who had influenced them and what they would like to ask this person if they had the chance. We had the pleasure of having five interviews with various thought leaders in the industry, the first one being with David Farmer. And in that interview, Thais from Brazil, she asked him about using drama to help encourage introverted learners and how drama could be used in the online teaching context. The second one was with Jane Willis, who spoke about task-based learning to Joe. And in that episode, we defined it a little bit. I think she got some great answers to the questions that she was asking about her particular teaching context. The next one was Tamara's question to Nick Peachy. And it was about ed tech, the future of technology in ESL and ELT, and what he thought was kind of on the cutting edge, what we needed to be expecting perhaps within the next 5 to 10 years. Very interesting. Our fourth interview was with Jim Scrivener, and he answered Oleg's question about demand high. And our final interview was with Chia Swan Chung, and she was talking to teacher trainer Basak from Turkey, and they were talking about the imposter syndrome, non-native speaker issue on our industry, and quite personally and interestingly about motherhood and how this can change the way one sees oneself as a teacher.
Great. And it was a great series of interviews. I think we really enjoyed doing them and listening and this these contributions, this back and forth between people. I found them personally really rewarding. I don't know about you, Christian.
Oh, most certainly. It was a real joy to bring teachers and their influences, if you like, together. Yeah, it was a real honor to do that and to listen to what they had to say.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. I think it was pretty exciting too for some of the people, particularly Christian, how you organized yours, where you managed to have both the person asking the question as well as the interviewee in the same virtual space. So Hats off and kudos to you for that.
With Jane and Joe talking about task-based learning, that was really something, actually. And,
yeah.
It took a while and it was a bit of a runaround to organize schedules to facilitate that, but it happened eventually. And then they ran with it, you know, I hardly need to ask very much, which was super.
So in today's episode, we're going to focus on three of these interviews, right, and reflect on them and to see how we feel about them later, and indeed, more importantly, how the competition winner who asked those questions, how they feel about it, having had a few months to reflect. Before we do that, did you notice any kind of themes, anything that sort of connected these five interviews? Did you get a sense of any sort of overriding topics, either of you?
I did, if I can jump in. I definitely did. I thought there were some pretty interesting parallels that were happening between the interviews. And something that really struck me was the focus on the teaching skills that have really developed, I'd say, over the last, say, I don't know, 20 years or so, that really move beyond what you could call the nuts and bolts of teaching. So there was a real focus, not so much on, and questions pertaining not so much to how do I teach grammar more effectively, or how do I clarify meaning, or, you know, how do I teach vocabulary? So not so much the nuts and bolts of that, but almost the softer skills, maybe the like a second tier level of teacher skills. So for example, with David Farmer talking about the importance of gently moving into drama and having that as not really so much a vehicle for language learning, but more of a holistic approach of engaging your learners in a more affective way, but accepting the fact that not all students are going to necessarily be very comfortable with that. Jim was also talking about, again, moving away from that nuts and bolts and talking more about the focus of error correction and how he feels that teachers need to always be looking for the learning opportunities, whatever those may be, and bringing back that idea of upgrading students in a variety of different ways. So moving away from what is the correct answer to how can I make that student's sentence or effort just that much better, and almost like from an individual basis. Chia was very clearly focusing on the very real and important skill set of communication strategies, international communication, again, very much apart from language instruction. Both Nick and Jane, I thought, were interesting. They were talking about the value of working with real data. Nick talking about how if in the future, you know, some AI bot is going to be called upon or utilized to do quick explanations of different forms of the present perfect, a simple, for example, or a brief overview of some conceptual ideas of, well, what does it mean if we use the past simple in this context? That it's like, okay, so isn't that the teacher's role? But I think his point is it's not the teacher's role. It's that interaction that is more a part of the teacher's role. And again, looking at those kind of second tier skill sets that I thought was, I saw that as a real kind of common thread running through all of them.
Okay, so let's kick things off by starting with the first of the interviews, which was with David Farmer. Let's listen to Thais, who originally asked questions to David. Let's listen now to her response.
Hi. First, I would like to thank DevelopPod for making it happen. And second, I would like to thank David Farmer for answering my questions. Well, it's been a long time since I recorded the first questions, and the world has changed since. I did learn a lot with the episode, and I thank you for it. I have talked with my fellow teachers, and we have resources to the website to look for content and for activities, the variations that you've posted, so we can use drama to teach online. And with the kids and young learners, it has been amazing. They love it, and they get so motivated. But it's funny, the first questions were about introvert and extrovert students, and I teach mainly teenagers. And something happened during this lockdown, during the pandemic. My extrovert students, the ones that used to be so sociable and so agitated and willing to participate, they shut down. They don't answer anymore. They don't participate. They don't open their cameras. They don't open their microphones. And I've talked to parents, and most of the parents have said that the students, they have depression and that they are going through some very hard times, and that lockdown has affected them in a way that the parents or the teachers did not expect. And about another question for you, I know that in the website, Drama Resources, you have lots of activities to deal with bully. Do you have any intention of having exercises to help with depression, or how a teacher, not only how, but what a teacher could do to help those students? I know this is a difficult question and a tricky one, but drama has always been the light of my life and something that makes me happy at all times. And if I could do something for my students, I would do it gladly.
So Thais had a few months to listen to the podcast, to think about it, and that was her very affecting response. Christian, what are your initial thoughts having heard that?
Well, it'd be really interesting to know what David says on this one. I'm certainly no drama expert, and I've used it and still use drama to some extent in teaching, but yeah, I'd like to defer to his thoughts. My initial thoughts, I suppose, it's really sad to hear, and I suppose somewhat understandable, Thais saying that extroverted students have shut down and depression has set in, and they're in classes not engaging with their cameras turned off. And I wondered what I would do in this situation. And I think it would need a real strong connection with your class to begin to broach this very serious topic. That said, it's an opportunity. So if done sensitively, then there could be a real opening here. So it made me think of Kieran Donaghy and the work he's done with various films as a backdrop and a springboard for discussion. And I looked around, and there are various films and episodes from series that have been used quite successfully to broach this topic of depression with teenagers, one being The Road Back, which is a short film made specifically for this purpose. So I might, with the right class, use part of the film as a springboard for discussion. The other possibility is that with sufficient connection with the class, I might use a technique called hot seating, which is a very common technique in drama, where with the permission of someone in particular, and you would need to speak to them separately prior to the class, they would act as the pivotal point, if you like, in the lesson, where people ask them questions, and this person could be the one suffering from a particular kind of depression, and the others would ask questions to build up a character. So I think it would be very useful, obviously, to wear a hat in this technique. And so obviously to kind of distance yourself from the question and allow that emotional security for the students. They wear the hat of a character, and then hot seating is done to build up information around that character, and then there could be suggestions from the group about what to do in this situation. Obviously, role play could follow on from that, but assigned roles where they could be playing, for example, the parent and giving advice, perhaps. So they're not necessarily playing themselves, and that gives them that security. Mm-hmm. And if, and it's a big if, there's enough rapport and genuine trust amongst the group, I might even suggest the technique of heart circling as well, of just talking about what's on your mind at the start of a lesson and giving each person a space just to speak from the mm-hmm. heart and building up that trust and having that time every week, every lesson, end of every lesson or the start, to just check in and share what's going mm-hmm. on. Because very often we talk about subjects, you know, shopping, traveling, blah, 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 and it doesn't really touch people's lives. Maybe mm-hmm. that's why people are turning their cameras off and they're not engaging, because it's so far removed from what they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. I agree. That was coming to my mind as well, with that idea of really not trying to avoid the elephant in the room, so to speak, where if students are feeling low or disengaged, ask them about it, speak to them about it, see if you can tackle it head on. I agree, it's tricky. You've got to approach it carefully. Something else that kind of came to my mind with that as well was Thais's original question, which was about introversion and extroversion. And she was keenly feeling how it was the extroverts who have become very low-key and disengaged and things like that. So I think it's also an interesting area to keep looking into. There's a book written by Susan Cain called Quiet. And it's an excellent, excellent book. I actually bought it for my son, who is very introverted. I think it sheds a lot of light on what introversion and extroversion really is and how it manifests. And that might also, again, just kind of better inform the conversation about how people are interacting online, what is comfortable for them, maybe how things have changed. I don't know. I think it's worth continuing to investigate. I still say this is a new experience, and we may or may not go back fully face to face. So I think just kind of parking it and thinking, oh, let's hope that this goes away in 5 months, might not be the best approach, because I think it is probably going to continue.
Okay, so thank you for that. That was very interesting. And I think that's a really sensitive subject. So I appreciate how you have tried to offer some practical suggestions while being mindful of the sensitivities involved. Let's move on to the next one now, which is with Jane Willis. She was spoken to by Joe. And so let's listen to Joe's response to the interview.
I found it really helpful speaking to Jane about task-based learning. For example, one of the things we spoke about was the flexibility of the methodology, how we don't have to be so worried about following a plan step by step. For example, with the reporting stage, the teacher can maybe have more input at this point, or the students can decide how that part should be delivered, or it can be shorter or longer depending on the level of the student. So it gave me a lot more confidence to incorporate task-based learning into my planning. In my current job, I have more freedom to plan my lessons with or without a course book. So I use task-based learning as inspiration sometimes for different activities. Jane suggested, for example, if we're doing a reading activity, the comprehension questions can be done at home. And in the classroom, we take the opportunity to give the students more time to speak and communicate in different ways, maybe taking the topic of the reading and doing a task based on that. And I think that idea of giving students different ways to communicate is something I really like. So maybe we're doing an activity where we're ranking something, or we are categorizing vocabulary. It just gives me different perspectives or different approaches to activities, which is really interesting. Or for example, if I'm introducing a new topic, I like to draw on students' existing knowledge rather than me presenting a vocabulary list. We can use the students' existing knowledge to create vocabulary lists and use that in the lesson. At the end of the day as well, Jane spoke about focusing on communicative achievements. So have the students communicated well what they wanted to say, and praising that and finding the positive points in their communication based on the content. We can also do language work to fix mistakes as well, but I really like that approach for my own teaching. And maybe one question I still have is now based on teaching online. So I hadn't anticipated at that point how much teaching online I would be doing in the future. And the transition using task-based learning online in the online classroom, where maybe I'm not using a platform that allows for so much group work, or I have different sizes of classes, is a new challenge for using task-based learning. So now I think my questions would be around adapting the methodology for the online classroom.
So Christian, what's your response to Joe's reflection?
Well, it's certainly heartwarming that the experience with Jane has given Joe much more confidence in terms of planning task-based learning lessons and flexibility with that report stage that she mentioned specifically, and assigning reading perhaps at home to be able to focus more on reading in class. And I have some reflections on her question. That said, I'd like to look at specifically what she talked about in terms of the activities that Joe suggested, ranking, categorizing, brainstorming new vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And I personally keep coming back to what constitutes a task. And the interview didn't really resolve this for me. It was just very loose. And I asked Jane about this. Now, Jane, I believe, is of the opinion that a task, as long as it has an outcome, is a task, and that may well be so. But there are certainly, let's say, tighter definitions around that. Rod Ellis's definition, for example, that it's typically something that individuals would do outside the classroom. Mm-hmm. And over and above that, that it's something that they need to do in the real world, and that should come from a needs analysis, like writing an email or making a reservation for, you know, an airline or whatever. Now, there's no right and wrong on this, but at the end, I was left with the taste that a task could be almost anything, and it's certainly, if Joe has interpreted the task as brainstorming vocabulary, then it seems to be completely open-ended to me. Mm-hmm.
I have to agree with that, actually. That was something that I kind of took away as well. And I often go back to the definition from Jane and Dave Willis's book, which is just what you said, Christian. It's a goal-oriented communicative activity. And so I always try to differentiate tasks from activities. And I think that for sure tasks can, activities can have outcomes, but I'm not sure I would call them tasks as much because of that lack of that real world communicative connection where there's a real need to exchange information, exchange meaning, and have students feel exactly kind of like what you said, that they are now achieving something that has a direct bridge to the real world, that they're walking over that bridge from the classroom to the real world by doing that task.
Yeah, completely. I mean, Joe gave the example of returning something to a shop as a task, and she said it wasn't completely successful, but Jane said it was rather a role play rather than a task because there's no real outcome. They weren't taking some shoes back to the shop. Well, if it's simulated, it seems to me that that is a task, and I get her point that it's in the writing of the role play and not necessarily the performing that there is a task. She seemed to come back full circle and suggest later on that that this actually was a task with a meaning focus, but in the meantime, you could do perhaps a matching task with a list of reasons why people take things back to a shop and matching them with the items, which is a language task for me, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it's a simulated classroom activity, I would say. Mm-hmm. Now, does this really matter? Perhaps not, if there's communicative tasks in the classroom, but as someone who's interested in pedagogy and talking about ideas and how we can translate them into the classroom, yeah. I think it is important if there's an over-preponderance on activities as opposed to tasks, which really, in my experience, fill students with joy that they can do real world things.
So Christian, do you have any thoughts about how task-based learning could be adapted for the online classroom?
Yeah, I guess I do. I've tried task-based learning online. I find that it's super successful because it's instant in terms of students engaging and seeing that what they're doing is useful. And I looked up online whether there were any useful articles, and there was an article by Baralt and Gomez, 2017, so prior to this new wave of teaching online with COVID, and it was entitled Task-Based Language Teaching Online, quite self-explanatory. And they talk about the reasons why task-based learning online may be different from face-to-face. I'm not sure I agree with all of their points, but their main point, the first point, was that tasks that work well in person may not always work well online. And of course, we've got to think about that. But in the main, I found that things have translated and there hasn't been an issue there. They say also that a significant amount of learners' attention is devoted to the social and technical factors being online, and that may not translate into optimum environment for, you know, practice task-based learning. Equally, it's a matter of getting used to the technology and getting to know each other online. I don't see that as an issue. They also talk about socializing and formation of trust, and again, that's part and parcel of the same thing, and that learners may feel more self-conscious in a video-based instruction program. Again, equally, I haven't found that. There may well be people who do, and I assume certainly that TIRES would find that with their teenage learners, but I haven't found that with adult learners. And also that teachers have to employ additional tools to successfully scaffold learners in the online environment. Yes, that I think that is a fair point. There has to be explicit scaffolding, and for example, giving of sentence starters or language cues and so forth. But then an experienced teacher would be used to that anyway. One point I thought was really useful was that we need to prepare students very well for a task-based learning lesson online. And they suggest, Barrel and Gomez, that task instructions and a video are given prior to the lesson itself to prepare a student. So, and they gave an example of someone introducing themselves, actually at kind of pre-intermediate-ish level, in Spanish, in fact, and we'll provide the link for you. And the video was sent to students along with detailed task instructions and language cues. So I think that's a fair point, that prepare students in advance.
I would totally underline that as well. I think that's an excellent point. And in my experience, yes, task-based learning has worked fine for me. But I would also highlight the ones that have worked the best have been highly personalized. So really making sure that the students are genuinely feel engaged with the topic and it is very personally relevant to them. And I also absolutely would totally 100% highlight that need for the prep and the scaffolding, because that opportunity for misunderstanding and confusion, I find it just, you know, can run rampant in the online context. There's such less wiggle room of little being able to put out tiny little fires that you can in the classroom. So I totally agree with that as well, Christian.
Yeah. And I've used this technique with my adult learners of them making videos and sending them in prior to the class. And then there's discussion around them in the class. And works. It works really well, whether it be introducing yourself or acting as a tour guide around your town. Nice. But I come back to the motivation for a task and the essence or the definition of task-based learning, if you like. And whilst it would be presumptuous of me to say what it is, I come back to this quote.
Be presumptuous.
Learners having to do a real task based off learners' authentic needs and lives gives them the capacity to feel a real sense of community. And if one of the factors that may mean the task-based learning online may not work, one of the obstacles may be the formation of this trust and community, then they surely need to be able to key into and be motivated by that task.
Yes. And I think maybe that is what people can speak to it in a if they're struggling with it. When you think about some of the tasks, like even taking stuff back to a shop, well, I don't know about in Canada, well, in Ontario, shops have been closed for a long time. So that there's a certain lack of relevance there. And maybe there's other things as well, like, you know, talking about getting your car fixed or whatever. So there is that creative adaptation, I think, that needs to come with making sure they remain engaging.
So that brings us to our final of the three interviews that we're focusing on today, and that was with Jim Scrivener. So let's listen to Oleg and his reflections.
Thank you very much for discussing my question with Jim. It was rewarding and interesting to listen to. What I particularly liked, or what I will take away from listening to your interview, is that, first of all, is the notion of learning-centeredness as opposed to the common dichotomy of teacher-centeredness versus student-centeredness. At the end of the day, it's how much learning took place or how much the students managed to develop their skills during the lesson is what matters. And therefore, having a focus on learning is always beneficial for a teacher. And I also like your discussion of the potential problems that a teacher might have when using the demand high approach. And specifically, you said that the teacher has to be able to say a no, which is related to his or her confidence. But I think what matters the most here is the teacher's attitude. By which I mean, if the teacher is genuinely interested in their students making progress, then he or she will find it far easier to say a no when needed. And finally, a comment on upgrade versus correction. Both you and Jim argued that upgrade is more efficient, but I think it depends. If your students have done a controlled practice gap fill on was and were, in which they made some mistakes. So here, we can't really use the upgrade approach and say something like, oh, it was okay-ish, but we can do it better. Conversely, I think the teacher has to be crystal clear here and point out what was right and wrong. Of course, the teacher may not want to say, oh, this is wrong, but prefer something along the lines of, are you sure that it is was but not were, to prompt the student to recall the rules. But when it comes to teaching the productive skills of speaking and writing here, I think the upgrade approach is much more efficient because there's a wide scope for students to improve in. Say, pronunciation, idiomaticity, coherence, cohesion, and whatnot. So here, when working on students' productive skills, upgrade is much more beneficial than correction. Thank you very much.
So Tanya, how do you reflect on Jim's interview now?
I appreciated Oleg's focus, actually, on... He really pulled out Jim's attention to learning centeredness versus student or teacher centeredness. And I think that really resonated with him. And I also respected his focus on thinking that it maybe had more to do with productive skills, that the demand high idea of everybody getting an upgrade as opposed to focusing on clear direction and correction was maybe a little bit more connected to the productive skills than it was to, for example, like grammar clarification. And he was talking about, his example of the was, were, if it's like a grammar gap fill, is there really much room for an upgrade? But I would also, I'd like to go back to what Jim was talking about with his 3XP as well, in how perhaps even if you're doing something as restricted as a form gap fill exercise, I really took on board Jim's idea of tweaking it and having them doing it again in a slightly different way. And that could be done depending on different learners' abilities as well. I also agree with Oleg, his opinion about that the teacher's attitude is very, very important in this, mm-hmm. And how it's related to confidence. I love Jim's focus on feedback. And that was something that I ended up, after listening to the recording again, I ended up down a little bit of a rabbit hole with Krashen and Truscott's take on how their ideas being that feedback is not only unnecessary, but also potentially harmful. And I really thought, wow, I think that really has influenced our industry, where this idea of positivity, tons of encouragement. Yeah, that's great. You know, and I really appreciated Jim's take on, is that really serving our learners so well? Like, is there not a way of providing clear feedback that is honest, constructive criticism, but is also very positive? Christian, what did you think?
Yeah, I think it all comes down to feedback and the value of feedback. And I've long since gone on about this as a director of studies with teachers. And I keep coming back to the work of Jeff Petty in evidence-based teaching. That is one of the factors that accelerates and promotes learning, this real focused feedback to give students an upgrade. And I must say thank you, Jim, because I've started to use that word upgrade now in my feedback.
Me too.
Yeah, I've actually started to use that word because it's so neutral. Correction is so loaded for so many teachers and teacher trainees that I've seen over time. Oh, can I correct? And they jump around and they're so embarrassed. And yes. I think it's partly a generational thing. We were taught to give feedback, and yet maybe it's also an experience thing. You start to see after years of teaching that that is what students need, that guidance from A to B. And that doesn't seem like rocket science to me. And yet I haven't used the technique, the specific technique 3xP that that Jim talks about so much, and I'm trying to do that a little more, the task repetition. Scott Thornbury, interestingly, also talks about it and talks about the task repetition as opposed to 3x practice. So, yeah, I personally learned a lot from it. I think I see where Oleg is going in terms of, the was-were exercise is more of an error correction around a kind of controlled practice as opposed to an upgrade around a productive skills. But to some extent, I think it's semantics. It's about bringing up the level of the student's knowledge and ability, and how do we do that? So, yeah, I'm glad that Oleg learned something from it, and he's just fine-tuning what he does there, I think.
Yes, I think so too. And I also liked that idea of it being, approaching each student. I love that idea of, would you like an upgrade? They can say no. Right. And I find I'm in the same boat with you, Christian, as a teacher trainer. I find it often quite amusing when trainee teachers come back and say, they loved when I gave them feedback. They weren't offended. They didn't hate me for it. Yeah. And it's like,
And why would they be offended? Right. They're a student to learn to learn a language.
In my situation, they often sort of demand it. In fact, they kind of want it too much. Whereas it's really important to them. And I feel like as someone who teaches predominantly more advanced learners, where, you know, mistakes are not so obvious, this idea of an upgrade is so useful, because what you're doing is saying, okay, I think the focus of feedback generally, people sort of default towards the mistakes is what they think feedback are, right? Correcting mistakes. But if you're teaching CPE, for example, then the chances are they're not going to make many mistakes, but that doesn't mean you can't give them an upgrade, you know? You can't take what they're doing and say, okay, that what you did was great, but if you want to be better, this is what you can do.
Yeah.
Yes, I totally agree. And I feel that when I teach the high, even intermediate and up, when you're saying what you've said is great, however, there's like, it's like a lack of flexibility for different contexts and different levels of formality. And then highlighting that as an upgrade is, I think, quite exciting for students.
And if I could link it back in with task-based learning again, perhaps, that we can offer them a model to compare it with. And it takes a discerning ear on the part of a teacher, I think, to hear what they're not saying as opposed to what they are saying.
And It took me a long time to learn that.
That's the difficult thing. What could they have said? And how can we inch them forwards in terms of, like, how could they ever express it more wholly or fully or with kind of better structuring or signposting? And that is the tricky thing, to have someone on your shoulder viewing that the whole time and be able to give mm-hmm. that feedback is quite critical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nicely said.
But the whole idea that of students being embarrassed, well, maybe they might be in the beginning, but that's our job as a teacher, to create that environment where learning is happening. And mm-hmm. that's part of the syllabus. Yeah, mm-hmm. that upgrading of language. Yeah.
Well, I also ran down another little rabbit hole, and that was about do students actually like or dislike feedback? And I read a couple of research papers on it, and it was pretty common that, like, yes, students wanted feedback, but when they were upset about feedback, it was because it was vague or mm. shame-based.
Mm, mm, mm.
So avoid shaming them mm-hmm. and avoid vague things like not so right. Like, say,
the nice stress try.
Is not, yeah, nice try. Can you do better? Well, no, that just makes people feel upset. But if you say, well, you've put the stress on the wrong syllable, put it on the first syllable, not the second syllable, it's like, oh, I get it now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there isn't that negative reaction. It's mm. it's a bit like, you know, being bad person. But why? It doesn't yeah. make sense.
Yeah. And I think it also comes back to the kind of somewhat passé idea of NLP, neurolinguistic programming, as well, and the language that we use as teachers and keeping it neutral. And as soon as we think it's a mistake in our own heads, then that gives it a negative connotation.
Yes.
And mm. that's why the word upgrade in itself is fantastic, because mm-hmm. it makes us think about the language we use mm-hmm. as teachers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that it's all a joyful a learning process, as coming back to having fun with language, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think you expressed that really well, Tanya, that that's how did you express it?
I don't know.
Well, whatever it was, it was great.
You. What did I say?
What? Yeah, I think you said, would you like an upgrade?
Yes, in asking individual students, exactly. Mm. And actually, sorry, there was one more point that the research did highlight, and it's about consistency. So what upset students was inconsistency, ambiguity, and shaming, like that type of that negative connotation. It's starting from the beginning of the class and saying, I'm going to be using this in my teacher tool belt. Upgrade is going to be how I focus and consistently. And I think that's really important.
So we've really enjoyed doing this series of interviews, and we'd like to continue doing them in the future. So if you'd like to get involved, well, Tanya, can you tell our listeners what they can do?
Absolutely. So if any of you don't have to be contest winners, if you have a burning question that you would like to ask someone in our industry, please do let us know. Please email us at tdsig.podcast@iatefl.org. We would love to hear from you.
We certainly would. Okay, so let's bring this episode to an end. Thank you, Tanya and Christian, for your reflections. They were wonderful and insightful and interesting, as always. Thank you to, of course, to Thais, Joe and Oleg for contributing their recordings as well. And of course, the original interviewees and everyone who was involved. We really mm-hmm. appreciate their contributions. If you want to stay in touch with this podcast, then the best thing to do is follow TDSIG on social media. Just look for us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast on all your regular podcasting platforms, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Christian and Tanya.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, as always.
Thank you, James and Tanya. Lovely to see you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.